on Wednesday. I'm KGW's
host. Quiet, please, ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because they're cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome to a Monday on the Radio Northwest Network. For more than, or almost 25 years, I should be correct about that, almost 25 years, that we have served the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. And I got to tell you, I start the day with a whole bunch of whys, and just among them, just to give you an idea of what's coming up. Why is Seattle punishing the victims of vandalism instead of catching the perpetrators and giving them some punishment? Why are they handing out condoms at the cuckoo's nest? And why is Multnomah County playing with lives by forbidding ambulance companies from actually supplying the service that people so desperately need? And I'll give you a specific example that's been in the news in the last couple of days involving a man stabbed with life-threatening wounds. And there was no ambulance. In a major American city, no ambulance available. And I will tell you why. We've talked about it on this show before. We've talked to the people involved. Now, Multnomah County will not talk about it. Not to me, anyway. But the ambulance company will, AMR. And AMR could put out a lot more ambulances, except Multnomah County is sticking to the letter of its contract and says, we will not let you operate those ambulances, even though there's good reason to believe that the way that they would have to operate would actually be a better way than the way that's required in the contract. In any case, glad to have you with me on a Monday. If you want to join what we call the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And if you want to vote in our poll, this one has to do with the Seattle story I'm going to tell you about a bit later. Should cities punish businesses for not cleaning up graffiti vandalism and doing it quickly? Now, if you think that sounds a little backwards, it does. But that's Seattle, that's Portland, that's most of the major cities of the Pacific Northwest. They are going to blame the victim of the crime instead of the criminals. They are going to seek compensation from the victim of the crime and not the criminals. That's the way they want it. They say if you get graffiti on your building, somebody else comes by and damages your business. If the city of Seattle tells you to clean it up quickly and you don't do it, that doesn't mean punishment for the person who did the damage. It means punishment for you, the business. It's almost as though, if you didn't know otherwise, you'd think that the city of Seattle and cities like it, Portland, are saying, we want to drive business from Seattle, from Portland, from every major Northwest city that has this ridiculous requirement. If you've got graffiti vandalism, most of the businesses don't want it either. But can you imagine telling the business, somebody else did this to you, and unless you get it fixed quickly, because the public has to see that sight, and it might actually remind the public that the city of Seattle is not doing its job. That's what graffiti vandalism shows you. They're not doing their job. So we don't want the public to see that. You go out. You pony up the cash. You fix that, and you do it quickly. And if they come back and do it to you again, and I'll give you an example of a business that's suffered multiple graffiti vandalism incidents. And they say, this is costing us an arm and a leg to get all this taken care of. And the city says, we don't care. Get it fixed quickly or we will fine you and punish you for being a victim of crime. With that kind of approach, if businesses fled the city of like Seattle more quickly, it wouldn't surprise me one little bit. If you want to join the conversation, it's easy. 866-HEY-LARS. And if you happen to be a naysayer, well, you go right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com and vote in our Twitter poll or X poll. You can find it at Lars Larson Show. and at LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, a couple of months ago, we talked to the guy in charge of AMR. That's American Medical Response. They are one of the biggest ambulance providers in all of America, and they have a contract with Multnomah County. Now, if you ask me, what does that contract require? In the contract, it says you must supply ambulances and you must have two paramedics on each ambulance. You are not allowed to run an ambulance with one paramedic and one EMT. In other words, somebody who's perhaps aspiring someday to become a paramedic, but they're not that at that level of skill or training yet. When we talked to the guy in charge and we said, is this a reasonable requirement? He says, well, we don't have a problem with providing the paramedics. We can't hire them. They're offering big bucks to hire people with paramedic training to be able to staff those ambulances. But while they're short of people, the man from AMR said, all we'd like is permission to operate more ambulances and do it now by having one paramedic and one EMT on each ambulance rig until we can bring the number of paramedics back up to where they'd like it to be. And why can't they hire them? I want to give you a hint as to why. They pay very good money for people to work as paramedics. There aren't enough of them. Problem number one. Problem number two, in places like Portland and Seattle and the other big cities of the Northwest, about 50% of the calls they go on involve the so-called homeless, meaning drug-addicted lunatics that you have to deal with as a paramedic. If you're imagining that paramedic work as you come into somebody's home and there's an older gentleman and he suffered a heart attack or a pulmonary attack of some kind and you say, we're going to fix him up and we'll be thanked by everybody. No, you may be dealing with somebody who's got hepatitis, maybe he's got AIDS, is a drug addict and is crazy. On top of all that, you may be in a place where your life is at risk and you're wearing a vest to make sure nobody shoots you or stabs you to death. That's what you're up against. So how much money are you going to have to pay to get people like that? So consider what happened Sunday morning, just yesterday. Two people got into a dispute around midnight or just after midnight at a bar. And they went out in the parking lot, and one man ended up stabbed multiple times. Now, that's a code one response or code three response, lights and siren. So the fire crew shows up for a first responder, so they're going to do the initial work and then hand it off to the ambulance. Only because of Multnomah County's insistence that AMR must operate with two paramedics, they were what they call condition zero. No ambulances available whatsoever. So what do? They put him on a tarp, they loaded him into the back of a patrol car. A paramedic sat from the fire department, sat in the back of the patrol car and tried to keep the pressure on the wounds so the guy didn't bleed out on the way to the hospital. Thankfully, they say he made it to the hospital. He is expected to fully recover. But this kind of dangerous situation that literally puts lives on the line, that guy could have died in the back of that patrol car very easily. I mean, a few more ounces of blood, he's dead. And who's to blame? Multnomah County. Multnomah County for not saying, if you're up against an emergency, we'll let you staff the ambulances with one paramedic and one EMT. Every state agency that runs short of personnel simply says, I'm sorry, we're short. We're not going to operate on the regular schedule. You can't do that with ambulances. And yet Multnomah County is choosing to put people's lives at risk because of its adherence to that contract. It's a Monday. It's the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Guys, for those who...
He may talk about serious issues, but even Lars has a sense of humor.
I have a joke for you. The government in this town is excellent and uses your tax dollars efficiently.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead, fish wrapper, or mainstream media bias.
Somebody please just fire Portland State University President Ann Cudd. The trustees of this failed institution should hold her responsible for failing to act when a group took over the main library last week. A pro-terrorism activist group that did extensive and expensive damage to that library. And get this, out of the 30 people arrested by police, only six of them were students. Cudd owed them exactly nothing. They were on campus and should have been trespassed off quickly. She did nothing when they broke the law. She decided not to tell the police. Go ahead, clear them out. She offered the criminals everything they wanted. No punishment, no expulsion, no charges. And this is what she got, and we get to pay for it. Cudd's Neville Chamberlain style of leadership fits Oregon very well, though. Governors ignore small fires that turn into infernos and kill people and wipe out whole towns. Leaders ignore drug legalization till literally thousands of people die in both Oregon and Washington. Oregon declares sanctuary status for illegals, Washington the same, and they deliver more rape and murder. Mayor Feckless Ted ignores crime and violence until Portland scores the highest office vacancy rate in all of the United States. But most of those trustees have paycheck jobs at other failed government agencies, so don't expect very much from that bunch. Our question of the day comes from Veronica. Lars, I got my vote by mail ballot filled out. I went to put it in the return envelope. The return envelope had self-sealed from moisture. I called the elections office number on the ballot. He said, well, if you still have the envelope, go ahead and get it into the envelope best as you can and then tape it shut. I told him, I don't want to do that. That's going to suggest tampering. I asked him to resend the ballot. Lars, how would they know if somebody tampered with the ballot since we don't get a security envelope anymore? So now they're accepting taped up return ballots. We truly are a banana republic, signed Veronica. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now.
Well, I'm going to give two Daily Grills today. The first goes to the Washington State Democrat Party. As reported by our friend Ari Hoffman at the Post-Millennial, faculty, students, and alumni at University of Washington rally in support of Hamas terrorist group. The flyer advertised the event featured one of the parachute gliders that Hamas terrorists used to invade Israel. The flyer advertising the Students United for Palestine Equality in Return, otherwise known as SUPER, showed a graphic of one of those parachute gliders. And guess what? The Democrat Party says you're supposed to support this. That's nonsense. But grill number two, even the Daily Dead fish wrapper has taken issue with what they describe as Oregon's ethically challenged governor, Tina Kotek. But, and here's a quote from their editorial. The move is too little and too late in light of internal emails that paint a concerning picture of what Kotek had allowed to unfold in her office in the past several months. Kotek's announcement suggests she doesn't seem to recognize what's raising alarm for Oregonians. Unfortunately, none of what the governor announced last week, neither the plan to produce a manual of policies defining the role of the first spouse, nor the news that her wife Amy Kotek Wilson would limit her duties for now, dispels the concern that we may have at the beginning of another trip down an ethically challenged lane. And you know, at that point, that's the Oregonian editorial board referring back to the ethical challenges of John Kitzhaber and his grifter girlfriend. Our best email of the day, but you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. I left the name off this one for security reasons. Hey, Lars, my wife and I were walking to our car tonight about 10 p.m. in Longview. I was about 30 to 40 feet behind her when somebody came up to the car, tapped on the window, and opened the door. She was in the driver's seat. I was riding shotgun. This happened on the passenger side. As he was talking to her, he was reaching in the waistband or his pocket. I couldn't tell. I started yelling and shouting at him as I sprinted. He took a few steps back and put his focus on me. In broken English, he kept insisting that we fight. I have a sneaking suspicion he had a weapon of some sort. I called Longview PD, who took down the information. We continued with our plans. They got back to me about 15 minutes later. They had the suspect in custody. Turns out, After I confronted him, he took to slashing three cars on the street, one of which is my work truck. I have no idea why he opened our door. We prayed hard after gathering our wits. He spoke broken English. As far as I could tell, he isn't from around here. My request is you put out a PSA letting people know that this kind of thing is happening in our backyard. Sorry. Hope you have a great weekend. A loyal Lars listener. Now, consider what's going on. You've got more and more lawless behavior just like that that's going on. You've got public officials who are unwilling to do much of anything about that lawless behavior, and yet you're still paying the same level of taxes that you've always paid in exchange for services that you're not getting. And then you've got idiots in government, like I mentioned, AMR, the ambulance company, that says we could supply almost 50% more ambulances very, very quickly. Just give us permission to staff them with one paramedic and one EMT. And by the way, I looked up some of the professional studies that have been done asking, is there a difference between an ambulance staff with two paramedics or an ambulance staff with just one and an EMT? Turns out that most of the studies show no bottom line difference at all between the results for patients with two paramedics or just one paramedic. It sounds as though it's just about the same as it should be. And unfortunately, Multnomah County is saying you will do what's in the contract. Until then, they apparently don't give a damn at Multnomah County if the whole region runs short of ambulances. Let's go to Mike. Hey, Mike, welcome to the Lars Larson Show on a Monday. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, how are you?
Hey, Mike.
Doing? So I'm really upset.
I'm doing quite well. What's on your mind? We kind of didn't hear you at first.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it sounds like your phone's having problems, so I'm going to give up on that. Let's go to Don. Hey, Don, thanks for the call. Thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hey, hope you're having a great day. I just wanted to make a comment on the dual paramedic situation that they want in Portland. I was a firefighter paramedic, retired. I'm retired now. I do see the importance of having two paramedics. The one thing that I haven't heard yet is back in the day, it was not required that you have an associate's degree to get your paramedic certificate.
Yeah.
It was simply a skilled certificate, degree, or what have you, and there was no shortage of paramedics at that point. And then along comes the OHA, and they decide, oh, wow, everybody needs to, you know, have a degree to be a paramedic, which is complete nonsense. I worked at it for 30 years, like I said, and I know many, many paramedics I'd put up against people with a doctorate degree that are paramedics. And so I think it would alleviate the problem big time if they were to drop that requirement. And I don't know why that came about. Maybe it was a money issue.
They've been doing credentialism with not just them, but with nurses as well. Thanks for the call, Don. You got the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. What a vegan actually is?
They say cows are bad for the environment because all they do is eat plants and fart, just like vegans.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program on a Monday. It's a pleasure to be with you on the Radio Northwest Network. And James Heap joins me now, former Marine, Oregon State House Rep, who is running for re-election. And Christine Drazen would like to take his seat away. Thanks for your service. This is the Marines, and thanks for coming on today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me, Lars.
Now, we had a little technical problem there. I'm not sure if we're going to be able to get it resolved or not, but we'll do our best, James. Will you bear with me?
Yes, sir. Yeah, I can hear you again. So.
Well, tell me about how this run is going, and what do you think? What should people make of the fact that Christine Drazen, who's disappointed more than a few people in her legislative votes, and then ran for governor, and sadly didn't do a very good job there either?
Yeah, no, it's at first it was more surprising than anything because I, you know, in the past I've supported her in her governor race, and I I had put up signs and, you know, supported her overall. And so it just kind of caught me off guard. But currently my campaign is, it's going really well. We're, you know, we're out there door knocking, getting about 500 doors a day. We've got tons of grassroots support and volunteers and, have had over 200 small donors so far. And it's going pretty well.
And you got some help from Terry Emmert, and that always helps. I want to know what you think we can actually realistically expect to achieve in the next legislative session. And I'm assuming you're going to be there, and it's not going to be Christine Drazen, because the legislature seems to be ignoring the biggest issues in the state.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that I do plan on addressing it. And the biggest one that I have an expertise with that I can reach across the aisle and work with the Democrats is with the mental health care and the drug epidemic. Because I wound up, I lost some brothers to the fentanyl, two brothers to fentanyl in 2014, and have been doing all I can to improve the treatment system here in the state since then. So,
then yeah, except a lot except of the veterans. When we say it's treatment, because if we can't get anybody to go into treatment, it doesn't matter how much treatment you have. And we're still, it seems to me, buying into the lie that Measure 110 and full drug legalization, which didn't work, is now going to be corrected by making it slightly illegal. It doesn't sound like it's going to work to me. Does it to you?
No, I think there needs to be some sort of hammer to get these people into the treatment, because dealing with the addiction that my brothers were going through, it was very apparent that they weren't just going to go in for no without somebody pushing them. And ultimately, the times that they did have an epiphany and say, "Oh yes, I want treatment, I want help," they weren't able to get in. And so those opportunities, you know, that we could have had, you know, the resources weren't there. And then there's also, you know, they need a little bit of encouragement to stay in treatment once they're in treatment. Because anybody through addiction like heroin, they're sick for like at least a month, and it's quite the journey. And yeah, we got to change something, and it needs to have a legal hammer to say, oh, if you're not fixing yourself, then we'll find an alternative for you.
Well, and the concern I've got is that as long as it's pseudo-legal, you know, a minor misdemeanor crime, and as long as we don't see major enforcement efforts, the people who are flooding the marketplace of the Northwest with fentanyl are going to keep on flooding the marketplace. And as long as the drugs are cheap, easy, and available, why would anybody quit?
Yeah, I look at it as we need to address the cartels flooding it into America also. And a lot of people aren't aware of in 2018, whenever President Trump had done different tariffs against China for the steel, China also started importing a lot of the precursors to make fentanyl and meth and importing it to the Mexican cartels. And so they've declared war on America, and they're killing people through this fentanyl. And so we need to deal with it on the south of the border side of things, which I can't address at this point.
No, but I mean, Biden's the only guy who can address that, isn't it? And Biden's chosen to just turn a blind eye to it. He brags all day long about how much he talks to Chairman Xi from the communist Chinese, but he doesn't ever bring this subject up and say, you got to stop this. And I know that within the last couple of weeks, we've seen evidence that the Chinese communist government controls the companies that are actually making the precursors. And they won't allow the stuff on the streets of their cities, but they're almost encouraging it to come to the United States. So we can't fight that end of it, but we could make it illegal to possess drugs and make it a serious criminal offense. And then you'd have the hammer you need to push people into treatment, wouldn't you?
Yes. Yeah. I know that, 2017, the Portland area decriminalized and made it a misdemeanor, and nobody even allowed that to come to realization, and all of a sudden just, you know, decided to go full decriminalization, and it's lunacy, because, yeah, you can't can't go from a Class C felony all the way down to a Class C violation and think that it's going to have any sort of impact on people. And so luckily we were able to recriminalize it, but it needs to go further.
Yeah, but just barely. I mean, a minor misdemeanor. I'm talking to Oregon State House Rep James Hebe, who's running for re-election. The other issue, and we're about to come up to it, is we've got wildfires that are almost inevitable this summer. We've had a very wet spring, and that means there's going to be a lot of fuel out there. And I have a feeling the state of Oregon still does not want to take the one step, which is active management of the forest and actual cutting of trees and earn some revenue and use that to pay to make the forest more fire safe. And yet that solution is available to them right now.
Yeah. The wildfire is definitely a growing risk every year. It goes back to the closing of all the forest roads in the Clinton administration. And now whenever outside of Estacada here, we've got tons of forests, but whenever one catches on fire, the fire department can't even drive to the fire to extinguish the flames because we closed all the access roads. And it's utter nonsense.
Do you see any realistic chance you could get your Democrats on the other side of the aisle to say, we're going to go ahead and force the reopening of those roads and force some additional logging and active management of the forest, or are they just not willing to buy that?
Realistically, I don't think much is going to happen in the short term, but long term, they're going to have to work with some of the people that actually maintain the forest lands, i.e. loggers. Otherwise, it's just a failing proposition. But
I mean, in the short run, they're destroying whole communities. Go ahead, James.
Yes. Right now, we have gotten them to start experimenting with thinning some forests and allocating some resources to thinning, and they're experimenting with it. Even though, like, we have forest engineers that are telling us, like, this is how you maintain the forest, but they won't listen to us. They want to do their own studies, own study bills, and we always got to worry about their alternative agendas when any time a study bill comes to light.
Well, I'll tell you what, James, share that study by Dr. Bob Zybeck, the one that shows that from 55 to 87, we had 30 years with no major fires at all. And now the last 30 or 40 years, all we've had is major fires every single year. That's James Hebe. He is running for re-election in Clackamas County, District 51. He's running against Christine Drazen. You want my recommendation? Don't vote for Drazen. Bad idea. Big disappointment. Vote for James Hebe. Back in a moment, I'll get to your phone calls and emails. And why is the cuckoo's nest handing out condoms to its patients when sex for them is forbidden? You're listening to A Monday on the Radio Northwest Network.
At least someone has a plan for illegal aliens.
Back in the White House, I will terminate every open borders policy of the Biden administration and begin the largest deportation operation in American history.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Monday. Always glad to get your calls. And we are on the Radio Northwest Network serving Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk. Punishing the victims of crime, to me, sounds like a non-starter. And yet, in Seattle, it has been the order of the day that if your business is vandalized by graffiti vandals, and I know there are some people who want to treat this like some kind of art, anytime you're damaging somebody else's property, your art could be the freaking Mona Lisa, and I wouldn't give a damn. What I care about is you're doing damage to somebody else. You are committing a crime, and there ought to be a consequence. Well, you know what the consequence is? There's a guy by the name of Quoc Dang, and he owns Saigon Deli. And it's apparently very popular. There's lots and lots of business. But along comes the city of Seattle and says, your graffiti on the outside of your building must be cleaned up. And if you don't clean it up, we will fine you $100 a day, up to a total fine of $5,000 if necessary. So imagine this. You get this notice. If you don't have it cleaned up in 2 weeks, you're out $1,500 and you're the victim of that criminal activity. That's the view that Seattle Public Utilities has. It says either clean it up or we will fine you $100 a day. And by the way, the owner, Quoc Thanh, the guy who owns Saigon Deli, says, we get this stuff all the time. Sometimes it's every day, sometimes every week. He's quoted on Como News. We don't know because we can't control it. Even if it happens in daytime and we see it, we can't do anything about it. He says he's had the deli for 30 years. Vandalism has been a constant problem in the area, which is why so many businesses have closed. Well, that and the fact that the city of Seattle decides you're the victim, so therefore you get punished. The criminals, we're going to let them go free. If anybody thinks that's sensible, I'd be glad to take the naysayer call at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Let's go to Lance. Hey, Lance, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, thanks a lot. I really like your show. You're a peach, man. Hey,
I've been described as a peach in a long, long time, but I'm glad for it. I'll wear that one with pride.
Okay, great. Hey, here's my solution for crime. It's very simple, very straightforward. Everyone that qualifies can open carry. Everyone, teachers, people at work, people on the road, anybody. And that way, you're at a convenience store, somebody's going to rob it, how many guns could they, be pulled on them? That's one. The second part is knock off all this criminal crap about protecting criminals and allowing them to perform crime. And that you, as a citizen, can use deadly force to stop any crime.
Any crime?
Your property.
Now, Lance, you're going to go beyond where I want to go, but, because you're saying if somebody comes out and starts vandalizing my house, I can just go out and shoot them dead?
Absolutely. Yes. Mm. It's your property. You get to protect it with deadly force.
Well,
just have it done once or twice, and it'll stop.
Oh, well, hey, look, Lance, one of my favorite authors, Robert Heinlein, a million years ago said an armed society would be a very polite society. And why? Because everybody would know there would be quick I'm not sure you could get that one past the liberals in either Olympia or Salem, but
anywhere.
The reason I like concealed carry, Lance, you walk into a convenience store and there are 12 people there. If one guy has or one gal has a gun on his or her hip, then you know which one is the armed one, and you probably shoot him first. On the other hand, if there are 12 people in there, there might be 6 people who are armed, and you don't know who's going to put a bullet in you if you decide to commit a deadly or present a deadly threat to people. Lance, thanks for the call, and thanks for listening. Let's go to Kelly. Kelly, thanks for calling. What's on your mind on this Monday?
Hi, I was just calling to respond to the story about Seattle and the graffiti and the business owners being made to pay to clean up their own graffiti.
Yeah.
Well, I think that if that were to happen to a business owner and they were told by the city of Seattle to clean up their own graffiti, that business owner should sue the city of Seattle for not providing adequate police presence in the first place. And if they just have to keep dragging it on and on in court, that's what they should do, because that's what the city would do to them.
Yeah, it would. I mean, the city would come along and say, Kelly, you're in violation of the following code sections, and we're going to make you clean it up. Have you ever noticed that the government does not clean up its own messes very well at all, but they expect you?
You
can't go dump garbage in your front yard or somebody else's front yard. They'll come after you. But if they dump garbage or allow garbage to be dumped on their property, they simply ignore the problem.
And they also don't pay, if they take a long time to pay you back for something that they do owe you, you're not allowed to charge them interest. But if you take longer or are late for some reason on something to do with something that you owe them, they charge you up the wazoo for interest. So I think any business owner that is attacked by the city of Seattle for being a victim, basically, should just turn right around and sue them and say, well, you didn't provide adequate police presence, and so you pay for it, or I'll sue you.
I've got a cheaper alternative, Kelly, but You just created an idea. Think about this. How many city properties do you see? Guardrails, jersey barriers, and the rest. If they're covered with graffiti, people in Seattle should start filing a complaint on every single one, demanding that the city fix the graffiti or get fined $100 a day. Kelly, thanks for the call.
The Lars Larson.
Ladies and gentlemen,
you ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because of cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
And they...
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now...
And then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host...
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Monday. Glad to get to your phone calls and emails in a moment. But my friend Josh Marquis, the former DA, is very concerned about one of the most consequential elections that is happening this month, in the month of May, in the Oregon primary, as a district attorney who is backed by George Soros and a lot of money from George Soros, and a district attorney who ran on the idea that he would not prosecute a lot of crimes. And he delivered on that, and it was a bad policy. It has led to all kinds of bad things, in particular in Multnomah County, that's Portland, for those of you in other parts of the Pacific Northwest. Mike Schmidt Show has been a disaster. And by refusing to prosecute criminals, Portland has more crime, as I've pointed out many times. Portland now ranks as number one in America for vacant office space. It is worse than every other city in the United States because of this. And people are getting hurt, and people are getting killed, and terrible things are happening. And now he'd like to keep his office. Mike Schmidt would like to be reelected. I would do almost anything to make sure that he is not. And right now, the polls indicate that his challenger, a former assistant district attorney, Nathan Vasquez, is leading him by about a third. There's a huge number of undecided votes, though, about 44%. But Nathan Vasquez is running against his former boss, and he's leading him 34 to 22 at this point, but with a gigantic number of undecided. So, Josh, welcome back to the program. Make the case for why voters can't afford to let Mike Schmidt continue in office.
Well, many people don't often pay attention to the race for district attorney because, thank heavens, most people don't have felony crime. Things like rape and murder do not intrude on their personal lives. The vast majority of people, it just doesn't directly affect them. But what's going on in Portland right now is directly attributable because the actions by the police, their failure to do anything about theft or the incredible disaster that Oregon's had with Measure 110, the legalization of drugs, which Schmidt was the only district attorney in the state out of 35 to think it was a good idea. And by the way, Nathan Vasquez is still a deputy DA. He's out on leave because, and Schmidt could fire him at any moment. But the guy who's running against him and the poll, which the only poll that's out shows Vasquez at 50%, Schmidt at 31 and 19% undecided. But that was only after the pollsters said what the positions as stated of each of the candidates were.
Right.
What's more terrifying is that both Oregon Public Broadcasting today and the Oregonian itself, which commissioned the poll, which is by a very reputable pollster, do not mention in the stories they ran today and appear to be running what almost looks like pure campaign propaganda on behalf of Mike Schmidt, quoting people from around the country who are anti-prosecution, saying basically not a single person in favor. The reason people should be concerned about this is that Schmidt has taken the position that the people he will listen to are criminal defense lawyers and criminals and their supporters. And when the district attorney is the is the person who stands up in court on behalf of the state of Oregon and the victims. And if the district attorney doesn't do that, there is nobody who can. A victim cannot put themselves in between a bad DA and a judge and a jury. So what's happening to Portland, I mean, you mentioned one figure, that here's another one that's absolutely terrifying. The increase in overdose deaths over the last 2 years in Oregon is 1,533%, yep, the absolute worst in the United States. And it's directly attributable to Measure 110 and the support for it. It goes right back to the current district attorney, Mike Schmidt. This is an election that will dramatically change the quality of life.
Do you want to bet that we're going to get to the end? Josh, do you want to bet we're going to get to the end of this year? And where last year, I think there were 1,200 fentanyl overdose deaths, there will be just as many this year, even with the legislature with this half-baked idea of saying, well, we'll make it a minor misdemeanor, and it'll look like we've recriminalized drugs, whereas they know that that's not going to be the case. They know it's not going to change anything. Do you want to bet that isn't the result?
I agree with you completely, because what the legislature did was the Democratic Party just saved their butts by passing something that is called deflection, diversion, and something else. And everybody who's got an addict who they love or know knows that you have to make addiction intolerable in someone's life for them to make the right choice.
Yeah, and the end result of all this is people getting hurt, including people who don't put themselves in harm's way. I mean, there are an awful lot of people who end up as the victims of crime. They're out somewhere in a sketchy neighborhood at 2 a.m. Now, that's some, but for the people who think, well, I'm just a regular person. I go to work. I go home. I'm on my own business. I don't go out at crazy hours to crazy neighborhoods. But the problem is this crime is starting to hit those people as well. Because you've got carjackings, you've got stabbings, you've got all these other things that are going on, and the criminals know there's going to be no consequence.
Absolutely. Just a couple of years ago, the employees of Columbia Sportswear called the parking lot in front of their building the laptop donation zone, because their cars were being broken into with such regularity. There are people that have, you know, that leave their cars open because they don't want them smashed. And, you know, I'm sorry, not every single neighborhood in Portland looks like downtown, but downtown looks like a war zone.
No, and you see the same kind of problem in Seattle, where you had entire companies that said, we're evacuating our personnel from downtown buildings at 3rd and Pine, because the problem is there, and the police and the officials, you know, King County prosecutor in particular, won't do anything about it. So, last word on recommendations, because you're right, we're about a week away from the May primary. And the only question I had last week as we ended the week was, in a lot of municipal elections, it's 50% plus one vote. If Vasquez gets to 50% plus one, does he win, or does it have to go to November no matter what?
No. The person who gets more votes than the other in the race is the district attorney. Will be cursed with Schmidt for another 7 months because he doesn't take office until January 1st. But Portland cannot survive another 4 years of this.
No, we can't. Josh, thanks very much. That's Nathan Vasquez, the guy who's the law and order candidate, versus the woke guy, Mike Schmidt. The guy who, a week ago Monday, stood there and said, we're going to prosecute the people who come out of that library on the PSU campus, and then within a couple of days announced, no, we're really not going to do much of anything to them at all. Back in a moment. I'll get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. Guys.
Um.
message from Lars.
I'd like to apologize to anyone I've not offended yet. Please be patient. I'll get to you shortly.
Who's next? This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. I want to say a couple of words about mass transit. And just so we're clear, I'm in favor of mass transit. And there's a lot of mass transit in America that works very, very well. In that case, Greyhound, the Bolt bus, every airplane that you see flying in the air that's a commercial airliner, that kind of mass transit works well. Do you know the kind of mass transit that does not work well at all? Anything the government gets its mitts on. And I'm going to tell you this, that you should just take a look at the results, because government has had decades to master mass transit, and all they managed to do is mess it up. In fact, in New York City, famously, the subway system was originally a private-run operation. And then they were going to increase the fare from, I think, a nickel to something more than a nickel to ride the subway. And people became outraged, and the government became outraged, and they said, we'll take over, and we will make it run efficiently. Now, what did the government do? The government took it over, it ran it inefficiently, and the fares went up even more than they would have as a private operation. I mean, you could think of dozens of examples where privately run mass transit or almost any kind of operation runs very, very well. Now, I know that some of you are going to say, well, Lars, you just hate government. I don't hate government. I view government as a tool, and not every tool works with every single problem. And generally, the tool, when it's government, has to be watched very, very carefully. Let me give you some numbers about mass transit. But first, welcome to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you happen to be a naysayer, let's say you're a fan of mass transit. Okay, good. Tell me where it works well with the government running it. In fact, you could even view Uber and Lyft as a form of mass transit. Not that you put a lot of people in every vehicle. Sometimes you do with Uber and Lyft, sometimes you don't. And I don't have a dog in the fight when it comes to Uber and Lyft. But if you take a look at how they operate, they're a profit-making enterprise. And the drivers who drive for them make money that compensates them for their time and effort. When it comes to government-run mass transit, it fails almost every single time. In fact, I've looked hard to see if I could find a single government-run mass transit system that actually operates. So when I saw this number, last year alone, the federal government spent $21 billion on transit. And the total amount they've spent since the 1960s is more than $1 trillion. So it's not as though you can blame the failure of mass transit on lack of funding. They've got lots and lots of money. And yet last year, with $21 billion going into mass transit, a record low number of commuters actually used mass transit. So it's almost as though if you build it, they will not come. You've got government that is shoving tens of billions of dollars into transit, and you get smaller and smaller percentages of Americans actually using it. Now, you may not like those numbers, but the numbers tell the tale. On average, the transit commuter share of all commutes in America last year dropped 42%. It went from 8.5% to 4.9%. So about 5% of Americans nationwide are going somewhere on transit. That means 5% of us are getting there some other way, usually a privately owned vehicle, whether it's a privately owned or a private car that you own or lease. But when it drops 42% in the year when you're pumping $21 billion into transit, the system is not working. And my friends at the Committee to Unleash Prosperity, that's economist Steve Moore and his friends, they pointed out if you look at the share of commuters riding on public transit in America's 14 biggest cities in 1960 and today, every single one of those cities has seen a spectacular decline in ridership. In all 14 cities, and these aren't rural city, these aren't small towns where you might expect that cars would be used more often. These are the biggest cities in America. Transit ridership has declined since the COVID pandemic ended. Now, I know that COVID is being used as an excuse for just about everything under the sun. People say, well, why is there a problem with this? Well, you know, COVID. They're going to use the pandemic for the next decade or so as the convenient excuse that fits just about everything. But when you see that the only place where mass transit even has a chance of competing is in New York City, and that's only because New York City is so damn dense. But in the rest of the country, it doesn't work at all. And if the taxpayers actually knew the numbers, consider this. When you pull up to the pumps and you pump gasoline or diesel into your rig, you might think, well, I'm paying gas taxes, but at least I'm paying for the roads I drive in. Well, you are, but more than you know, because 40% of federal gas taxes don't go to roads and highways. They go to mass transit. So that money is taken out of your pocket. And in most cities where they have a big mass transit agency, they have a tax base that supports that as well. In other words, everybody pays for the kind of transportation that about 5% or fewer people actually use. Everybody pays, a small group is benefited, except that small group is getting smaller. And this is even though cars are expensive, fuel is expensive, parking is expensive. The roads are becoming deliberately jammed up by Democrat policies that say, we're not going to build roads. We don't want people in cars. And I was telling a lady last week, she said, well, you know, they want us all on mass transit. I said, do you realize the impossibility of that? If 5% of Americans commute by transit right now, if that number were to go up gigantically, it's not, it's going down. But if it were to go somehow, Joe Biden could wave a magic wand and double the number of people on mass transit. It would go from 5% all the way to 10%, which would still leave 90% of us getting to work, getting to school, getting to the grocery store and everywhere else. 90% of us in privately owned, usually single vehicle transport. That's how it would work if you could double it. And if tomorrow in the biggest cities in America, you doubled the number of commuters taking the bus or taking the train, it would absolutely overload the system. And everybody who could would flee from the system. They'd say, this doesn't work for me. It's taking me twice as long to get to work. And people do value their time. I mean, even if you're making minimum wage, you value your time. And for most people, if you go online and you plot out a certain map to work, maybe the way that you go in a car, and then you say, I've thought about getting rid of my car, get rid of the payment and the insurance and the gasoline and the maintenance. And when I need to have a car, I'll either call an Uber or for a longer trip, I'll rent a car. And then you punch in the numbers and you say, how long will it take me to get to work on a regular basis or get to school on a regular basis on transit? And they tell you 3 times as long, 4 times as long. Oh, by the way, the trains and the buses don't run very regularly at that hour of the day. So you may not be able to get to work on time at all unless you're willing to get to work 45 minutes early and sit there cooling your heels and twiddling your thumbs. This is the reality you're up against, that government at the federal level, state and local level is pumping massive amounts of money into mass transit that Americans are not going to ride. Anytime you tell somebody we put $21 billion into transit last year alone and the number of people riding it went down by 42%, that is a failing system, and it's also a very expensive system. We ought to just turn it all over to Uber and Lyft and let people pay a bigger share if they want to be able to call up mass transit and ride it that way. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest
Network. The Lars Larson Show. And now, this musical message to anyone who wants to indoctrinate our school children. Hey, teacher, leave it alone. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show on First Amendment Friday. Glad to get to your calls in a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@larslarson.com. I want to welcome Sergeant Betsy Bratner Smith, who's spokesperson for the National Police Association. And Betsy, I got to tell you, we've got every different flavor of protest and reaction to it in America. We've got the big, bright blue cities where the protests are being met with acquiescence from the college administrators. We've got the red state of Texas that has said, you come down and break the law, our folks are going to come down and put zip cuffs on you and load you up and take you away. And then I have to throw this one at you, Betsy. At the University of Washington in Seattle, which is my neck of the woods, I don't live in Seattle, but it's a couple of hours away, they were going to have their Palestinian encampment begin yesterday. But get this, they got complaints that the group that was organizing it was too white and they didn't have enough Muslims and Arabs, so they have temporarily delayed their anti-Jewish, anti-Israel encampment until they find a way to generate enough Muslim and Arab participation, because otherwise it's not legitimate. If just a bunch of white people show up to hate Jews, I guess that doesn't work as well as when you have a diverse group there.
You know, Lars, right where I sit now in Phoenix, Arizona, at Arizona State University, they're being taken over too. And as I watch the video of that, it's a largely white, primarily, I'm guessing, liberal protest. If we were going to racialize it around the country, we'd be left with very few protesters, wouldn't we? Maybe we should do that to stop all this nonsense.
Maybe that is, but I wanted to know what your suggestion is, because it seems to me the college administrators, many of them in private colleges, and yet even though they're private, many of these colleges, like Columbia, get hundreds of millions of dollars from the United States Congress. And if I were a member of Congress, I'd say, cut that money off right now. If they can't control their own campus and make it safe for students and faculty, then they're not going to get federal tax dollars either.
Well, we have to look at what this is. When was the last time that students were being prevented from going into schools because of their race or their religion or their ethnicity?
George Wallace in Alabama.
And what party was that? I've just got to throw that out there and remind people.
Betsy, I make people angry all the time by calling it the party of slavery since 1829, and their founder was Andrew Jackson, who was no friend to persons of color in America, and they've been racist ever since. I mean, that's the party. It's the party of Joe Biden, who's so racist his vice president called him a racist on the campaign trail when she was still making her fateful run for president, which didn't work out very well.
Well, and of course, what we saw at Texas, at University of Texas Austin, was a wonderful multi-agency police show of force. They were legal. They were constitutional. Because you do have a right to protest in this country. I was a cop for 29 years. I had to stand and listen. You know, I had to stand and guard people who were Nazis, who were anti-Semites, who were pro-abortion, all the things that I don't care for. But as a law enforcement officer, I don't stick my nose into your politics. I stick my nose into the law. So we had this terrific show of force. Law enforcement did a great job in Texas, and what happened? The Travis County prosecutor, the Soros-installed prosecutor, dropped at least 46 of the cases, 46 of the arrests of these students and primarily outside agitators, as the college president said, at the University of Texas. And this is the thing. What do I think should happen? I think if they break the law, they get arrested, then they get prosecuted. And remember, that's not up to the police. And nope. Then if they're a student, they need to get expelled. That's how you stop all this anti-Semitism, all of this pro-Hamas, pro-Hezbollah, pro-terrorism garbage happening around this country.
No, and I wonder if people see the parallels here, because you have the state of Israel. You have a group of people who have occupied part of the state of Israel. I know they see the Jews as the occupiers, but they're not. It's their country. That was decided more than 70 years ago. So you have a large group of people, largely linked by culture, religion, and ethnicity to some extent, who's occupied part of the country and then say, hey, this is ours. You have to give it to us. And, oh, by the way, if you don't, we're going to kill you, and we might kill you anyway. And I wonder if people have looked at the parallels of a large group of foreign nationals who come into somebody else's country illegally and occupy a big chunk of it and then just demand, possession being nine-tenths of the law, we own this. That may be happening to us right now, and we might find ourselves in the same boat that Israel's in, only a much bigger boat.
I think you're right, and I think what needs to happen, a couple of things. First of all, I'm going to tell you that most of these protesters probably couldn't find Israel on a map, probably have no idea what the conflict is about, what is Gaza. They probably don't understand Palestine isn't a country. None of them know the history. And then I don't really think that they understand the historic nature of these protests that they're involving themselves in. And I'm guessing if you showed them maybe 2 or 3 minutes of videotape from October 7th, that they would be so horrified and disgusted that they would leave these campuses, leave these protests, and maybe develop a better understanding of what they're involving themselves in. But Lars, this is Occupy Wall Street. This is Antifa. This is Black Lives Matter. These are all the protests that I personally have, as a law enforcement officer, have dealt with for the past 20 years. You know, it's just that now it's their kids.
Yep.
And it's all the same. It's the same Soros and similar money. Who do you think is buying the tents?
Oh, it's, you know what, Betsy? I've already told people. I've told folks that Soros has been directly connected through one of the Soros-funded entities to at least 3 of these, and I believe he's connected to all of them. Although, it should scare us all that I think Soros was involved in Antifa and BLM, although it was very difficult to draw a direct link. The money went from here to here to here. Now, they're not even bothering to hide it. And when the folks who are organizing have said, yep, that's who we're funded by, and you say, so you're admitting it, yep. When they stop being afraid to identify who's funding it, it's because apparently Soros and his entities are no longer trying to hide it. They want people to know we're making this happen, and it is tearing America apart. Hey, by the way, Betsy, one quick thing before I have to break for a hard break. Where can people give to the National Police Association?
Thanks so much for asking. If you could go to nationalpolice.org, that's nationalpolice.org, hit that donate button, and whatever you can give to help us help the American law enforcement officer and the people who support us. We so appreciate it.
Nationalpolice.org. That's National Police Association, retired Sergeant Betsy Bratner Smith. Back in a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
Every one man, he blames every one man. Everything he's done, man, is the work of one man. Tell him not to run, man, he blames everyone. He blames the GOP when it's he wrecked the economy. Shift the blame, change the game, you should hang your head in shame. Film a tank, you to thank, it's enough to break the bank. Future's weaker, we are bleaker, and you want to blame the speaker. He blames everyone, man. Joe blames everyone. It won't be his fault, man, when we have to default, man. Shameful exit plan, man, from Afghanistan, man. Keep on blaming Trump, man, 'cause you blame everyone. You need to confess, man, you have caused this mess, man. You will not address, man.
Ask Lars if he wants to run for public office, like president.
Do you know how much power I'd have to give up to be president?
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I want to give full credit for this to my buddy Ari Hoffman up in Seattle. He's on our Seattle affiliate station, KVI. But what he's found is, and this was the bulletin he sent to me, after reviewing hundreds of hours of social media and video footage, the Washington State Patrol is said to be preparing the documentation to charge 6 pro-Hamas activists, so I would call them pro-terrorist activists, for blockading Interstate 5 last month. Another 10 are still being investigated. Now, I'll reach out to Washington State Patrol. Lately, we've not had that much luck with WSP, but I'd like to know whether or not they are getting ready to hand over the information to prosecutors so they can go after some of these pro-terrorist protesters. And for what? for the crime of blocking Interstate 5 last month in this protest. Another 10 under investigation. We'll let you know whether or not that develops anything, but great credit to my friend Ari Hoffman. Now, this segment of the show is brought to you by the home power generating folks at ProTech Power. You know what it's like? We've had snowstorms, and we've had them recently, and the power goes out. Make sure your loved ones are safe. When the power goes out, call 541-ONA-GEN. That's 541-ONA-GEN. Let's go to Mike. Mike, you heard me talking about that guy in Texas who hunted down the pedophile and then killed him. If you were sitting on the jury, before you make your comments, if you were sitting on the jury and he was charged with murder, would you vote to convict him?
Boy, that's a tough question, Lars. I mean, you know, my gut says no, but I'm with you. I don't want a country full of vigilantes, but I'd have a hard time, you know, throwing the book at him. I guess, you know, what I wanted to say was that I read somewhere that there's over 1 million people that are sex trafficked in America today. So this is a really big problem that our country has.
I believe that's true. That's probably about right.
And I don't believe that our officials are doing enough to stop it. There's got to be a bigger affront to this. They're treating about like they do our borders, as in your last segment. You know, they're just not doing much of anything. I guess I would answer your question with maybe another question, and okay. I know this isn't exactly parallel, but what if I just came from the bank a little while ago. What if I were in the bank, and I happened to be standing in there, and somebody else tried to rob that bank, and I shot that person and killed him? Should we punish people for saving lives in a case like that? I mean, this guy had every intention, it sounds like, of molesting children, and this fellow just stopped him from committing crimes.
See, and I'm with you, and Mike, you know what the jury would one of the issues they'd have to consider, because I'm not a lawyer, and I always remind people of that, but generally they'd have to say, did you feel your life was at risk? You're staying in the bank. A robber walks in. He sticks a gun in somebody in the teller's face and tells the teller, put all this money in a bag. And if he's got a gun, and it's out and it's pointed at a human being, I think any reasonable jury would look at that and say, you could reasonably believe that your life was at risk as well. The guy might want to leave without witnesses. And you say, now that he's pointed a gun at somebody, I think you've got a reason to protect yourself by acting in a reasonable way. And that's usually the reasonable man idea is the one that the prosecutor is going to go off of. Now, does that mean you're not going to get charged with, say, manslaughter or with murder for shooting the guy? They may charge you, but then you can make the self-defense argument. I believed at that moment when the robber pulled his gun out, he was likely to shoot the teller and shoot me too, and you killed him. In this case, it's tougher because the guy who hunted down the pedo, and I remind people, this guy had a conviction for child pornography. He was required as a convicted sex offender against children to register as a sex offender. He did not register as a sex offender, but he believed that he was meeting a child for the purpose of sex when he met up with this guy. And was this guy defending the community? I'd argue that he was. And I hope he pulls a self-defense or a choice of evils defense, says, look, I went out and I hunted down a pedophile. And the man I talked about from 40 years ago, the man who killed the guy who had molested his child, the karate instructor, the fact that he got no prison time, no jail time, probation, and some community service is kind of instructive about what some communities would do with a case like that. Not all of them, but some of them. Mike, thanks for the call. Let's go to Greg. Hey, Greg, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I got a question. Like, if you're a private company, can't you refuse service to any customer because you're a private company? So say these people are getting on the plane illegally, Alaska, because it's a private company, say, we're refusing service to you because you're a danger to our company.
Yeah, I would argue yes, but here's where you're going to get in trouble, Greg. If Alaska or any other airline said, we're going to start refusing service to any of these illegal aliens, the ones that are getting on with a special TSA ignores the fact that you have no picture ID, and they truly don't know who you are. Alaska could do that. what ethnicity is going to be the majority of the flyers that Alaska then refuses?
I mean, you can call racism, but it's not about racism. It's not.
Well,
about
I understand that, but you understand. I'm just making it clear that Alaska is going to face somebody who's going to say you're refusing a large percentage of the people you're refusing are Hispanic, and that's one of the few categories that if you're Hispanic and a business says we don't wait, you know, we don't provide service to people, and most of the people you say no to are Hispanic, you're going to find yourself in a lawsuit real quick, and you're probably going to lose. Plus, you're going to get all the bad publicity to boot.
The Lars Larson.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because of the cops, the next time you get in trouble, call it crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, even as the teachers' unions are demanding gigantic increases in funding, and even as schools are going to citizens all over the country and saying, give us more money for salaries, for buildings, for resources of one kind or another, American satisfaction with the quality of K-12 government-run education has fallen to a brand new low. But what aspects of education do parents value most when it comes to their kids? Chantel Lovell joins me now, who's Vice President of Communications for EdChoice. Chantel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Lars.
So tell me about this. You'd think that any institution that has customers, in this case the most direct metaphor to customers, would be parents and their kids who use the government-run schools. We all pay for them, but people with kids of K through 12 age and make use of them, and parents aren't very happy these days. I hear it all the time. So what are the things they actually like? And then we can get to whether or not the schools can start supplying the things that parents and teachers or parents and students are demanding.
Well, each month at EdChoice, we do a nationally representative survey of not just parents, but also just American adults. And we do find what you're saying, that people think education is headed in the wrong direction. They're not particularly happy with their schools. And we just did a deep dive into parent opinions. And I think for schools that are listening, that schools that want to listen to their customers, parents have given them a roadmap. We found overwhelmingly parents are saying they want schools to educate, not indoctrinate. We surveyed 1,500 American parents, and 84% of them said they want teachers to keep their politics to themselves. They want schools that emphasize STEM, so they want more technology taught over humanities. They want schools that are more likely to discipline than not, and they want schools that emphasize national pride.
Now, are there any schools out there that maybe provide a model for that? Where you look at it and you say, they're doing it. They're doing all the things that the parents like and none of the other things. You know, I saw, for example, Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg. So his husband was out giving the rainbow flag pledge. And it's outraged a lot of people, and I think rightly so. I mean, number one, they should be outraged because you shouldn't be indoctrinating kids one way or another to anything political. And yet there are people like that, Buttigieg, who are saying, no, this is exactly what we want to do with your kids. And I don't think parents like that. Are there any schools that have kind of led the way by saying, this is the way to do it, we keep the politics out, and we emphasize actually learning things that will benefit the kids?
Well, they're all over, but we don't hear a lot about them because many of these schools are newer forms of learning models like micro schools. They're small environments, or they're hybrid schools, which are a blend of homeschooling and micro schooling or small private schools that parents are increasingly turning to that better reflect their values. These surveys that we do at EdChoice are representatives. So they include Democrats, they include Republicans, they include everything in between. And we find that parents want schools that reflect their values, whatever they may be, and school choice is a way to get there by empowering parents with the freedom, the flexibility, the funds to send their children where they want to send them. They're able to choose a learning environment that does educate and not indoctrinate, as we found. This survey also found that 64% of parents, if given the choice, if they were looking for a new school, would choose a hybrid school. There was also very strong interest in micro schools. So these newer learning models, these unconventional ones, are growing in popularity because people are realizing that there are ways to make sure schools are teaching what they want. And it may not always be in the traditional public school system.
Do you ever do surveys of the people who actually run the government-run K-12 schools? To find out what, not just what they think, but whether or not they're aware. I mean, they may be in an echo chamber where they think everything they do is perfectly hunky-dory, where the parents and the students and the community are angry over it, and we only see it spill over when it actually turns out to be a specific controversy. But do we have any idea how they're viewing this? You know, if they say, well, we didn't realize there was a problem, because some of them seem to be oblivious to the fact that they're really offending a lot of people.
We don't survey administrators, but we do survey teachers twice a year. In fact, we've got our twice annual teacher survey coming out, I believe, in April. And it's always interesting to see what teachers find. And it's very affirming for me, and I think for a lot of listeners, in that teachers also value schooling as a place to teach children core academic subjects. We know that parents of kindergarten through eighth graders, they want core academic subjects and socialization to be top priority. And for teachers and for parents of high schoolers, they really value instilling skills for future employment. We've also been seeing a trend among teachers when we survey them of an interest in themselves in teaching in alternative learning environments. Now, we don't dig into why, but
they want to get out.
That there might... You know, I will leave that to you and your listeners to infer, but there is a lot of interest among teachers in teaching elsewhere.
I mean, it just seems, because I think one of the reasons the teachers' unions don't want to have school choice is because they realize if people had a choice, they'd go somewhere other than here. And isn't that kind of an indictment of the product itself? Chantal, if I ran a restaurant, and I said, well, I'm the only game in town. I'm the only restaurant in 50 miles. So if you want to have a dinner out, you got to eat here. You know, and if I said, but if my competition comes in, I'm going to lose half my customers. That would be an indictment of me, not the customers. I'd be saying, yeah, the only reason I have these people is because they're forced to be here. And I think, frankly, that's the way the schools have treated parents and students.
Absolutely. And we know that competition improves not only outcomes for students in the private school system or that go that opt for homeschooling, but also those students that stay in the traditional system. Teachers unions, unfortunately, are consistent opposition to providing more choice. But right now they're losing. We are seeing a groundswell of support across the country for policies to empower parents. Just last week, Alabama enacted a new school choice program that will be available to all students in the state, giving their families up to $6,000 to send their children to whatever learning environment they want. And in Wyoming, the governor has a bill on his desk to do something very similar. So we currently have 10 states, or 11 with Alabama, that offer all families school choice. And there are 33 states that have some sort of program on the books.
Chantel, where can people find this data? If they want to go look it up themselves, my audience, where can they find it?
Check us out at edchoice.org. This parent poll is front and center on our website, and we have a lot of other information as well.
Chantel, thank you very much. I appreciate the time. That's Chantel Lavelle, who is Vice President of Communications for EdChoice. Glad to get your emails. talk@LarsLarson.com. Check out my Instagram feed. And, of course, you can always tell Alexa to play the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Well,
Donald Trump with a warning to Hamas at the Republican Jewish Coalition Conference.
If you spill a drop of American blood, we will spill a gallon of yours.
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. Glad to have you with me. And if you want to join the conversation, it's 866-HEY-LARS. Send emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. Vote in our fresh daily question on X. You can find it at Lars Larson Show. And if you don't like X, formerly Twitter, you can go to our website at LarsLarson.com. Well, we can't get the Republicans and the Democrats together on a border solution. We can't get the Democrats and the Republicans to say, let's not send tens of billions of dollars off to Ukraine. We can't get the Republicans and Democrats together on just about anything. But apparently they got together and said, we don't want TikTok in this country. And they voted it by a very large margin, 352 to 65 in the House of Representatives, with only one person voting present. So I thought I'd get an intelligent view of this. You get my view. But Miles Yu joins me now, who's a senior fellow and director of the China Center at the Hudson Institute. Miles, welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you for the very kind word. Sometimes I'm intelligent. Sometimes I learn my wisdom from listening to your show.
Yeah, but the plus, and thank you for that, but the plus here is that neither one of us has yet been replaced by AI. But who knows? It could be coming. Let me ask you this. Is TikTok a Chinese spy device, and does it present a real threat to the United States?
It's a much bigger than a spy device, because in China, virtually every new technology is subjected to coercion by the Chinese intelligence security agency. So the country, basically, the party owns what's called the means of production. So they have all kinds of laws subject every business enterprise into compliance with the Chinese intelligence security demands. So TikTok is a powerful social media outlet. It can operate here in the United States in a free market system, but ultimately it is controlled by the Chinese Communist Party. And much of that is not just gather intelligence, but also to influence public opinion in a very powerful way. And that's why, and also can easily interfere with the Americans' public opinion and the democratic processes, particularly during election season. So that's why it's far more pernicious than a near intelligence gathering.
In fact, Miles, I want to ask you a detail about this that I've run across from time to time. TikTok isn't that big in China, is it? Don't they have an entirely different social media that's the dominant one in China?
So TikTok and the Chinese version of TikTok, which is called Douyin, is yep. owned by one giant company called the ByteDance.
Yeah.
ByteDance is controlled 100% by Chinese Communist Party. Now, the two versions are very different. In the Douyin, the Chinese version of TikTok, is 100% propaganda tool. It's basically, there's no competition, in other words, in China. Now, TikTok is different. It has to be a little bit more slimy, more careful, because it has competition. Yeah, it has competition like a Facebook, like other outlets. So they try to talk to the United States, bamboozle the regulators, say, hey, listen, our servers were outside of China. That's true. But who has access to the servers? Well, the Chinese Communist Party. So the TikTok's management could never say to the U.S. law enforcement that my business is completely separate from Chinese Communist Party. In other words, Chinese Communist Party would have no influence upon my business operation. They cannot really guarantee that. So you can see it's really, really sticky, and it brings up actually a much bigger issue. That is, should the United States engage China economically when the entire Chinese economic system is non-market, is controlled by a Communist Party? That's really the issue. So you may be able to operate in China temporarily, but the party actually control you. So that's why this bill to ban TikTok, to separate the ownership actually of TikTok from the Chinese Communist Party is there. But the issue is the Senate. I'm not sure, because a lot of senators who are basically influenced by all kinds of Wall Street groups, and they are now wobbly.
Well, and let me ask, the reason I ask about the Chinese version is because, as you said, that's a pure propaganda tool. So they did a toned-down version of their pure propaganda tool to put it in the United States to make it attractive as a place for people to exchange ideas and all that, and to suck up all that information. They'd never have gotten away with putting the pure propaganda tool of their own homegrown TikTok in the United States, or could they have?
Well, they could not survive the, you know, the first scrutiny in the United States. The Chinese propaganda is pretty, like, there's no cover. They were just unhinged. it cannot be, it really cannot be. And now, I must say one thing, though, before my time's up. Now, in the Senate, many senators were arguing this really is about First Amendment issue. That's why they cannot really support this as well. This is not true, because you cannot really include Chinese social media into the sort of First Amendment environment, because there's no such a thing in China that is about the First Amendment, freedom of expression. There's nothing there, precisely for the reason of protecting Americans' First Amendment rights, that TikTok should be really separated from Chinese Communist Party. That is enemy of the free speech. That's why the argument against the bill First Amendment ground is really not really that convincing to me.
Well, and frankly, if this was just another commercial enterprise and a platform for free speech, ByteDance could sell it, make a pile of money, and say, all right, it's now owned by a United States company that owns TikTok. ByteDance would walk away with a big check, and the U.S.-owned company could continue to grow TikTok in America and make lots of money with it here, but wouldn't be shoveling all that data back to the Chinese Communist government. Do you think they might do that if this law passes and say, okay, we'll divest of TikTok?
I think what this law does is to put the burden of proof on the TikTok management itself. They have to really certify to the public, to the American regulators, that it is not owned by the Chinese Communist Party. It has nothing to do with the Chinese Communist Party, because there is no ownership relationship. So that's all about. Now, TikTok has launched a massive public opinion campaign against the passage of this bill, mobilizing all sorts of really coercive measures, and of course teenagers love TikTok because they're addicted to it, and that is another side of the pernicious effect of the TikTok, because it's addiction. It's a sort of a cyber fentanyl.
And yet, if they got rid of it, you'd still have all the other social media that's U.S. based, and you would simply have said, if you don't want to prove that you're not owned by the Chinese Communist Party, then you're not welcome to do business in our country. That's Miles Yu. He's a senior fellow and director of the China Center at the Hudson Institute. Miles, it's a pleasure always to have you on the program. If you want to weigh in, we make it easy. 866-HEY-LARS. Naysayers go to the head of the line. You can send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Vote in our X poll. That's not controlled by the Chinese Communist government either. Check me out on Instagram and tell Alexa to play the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show. Solid advice from Senator John Kennedy.
Look, if you hate cops just because of the cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
This is the Lars Larson Show. You've seen him on News Nation.
He is the worst president we have ever seen, period.
Now, Hear him with Lars.
Politics and media has become like a form of silly sports fanaticism instead of the serious work of improving society.
This is the Chris Cuomo Perspective on the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I'm talking to Chris Cuomo. You know him previously from CNN, which I call the Chicken Noodle News Network. He's now at News Nation, and you can catch his show 8 p.m. East Coast, 7 p.m. Central. Chris, I got to ask you this. Is there any good reason for America to have state-sponsored media in the form of NPR?
The argument is that if the government is financing it, it doesn't have profit motives. Therefore, it's liberated from the commercial exigencies. I'm always more, it's complicated with the news and information business, but I'm still in favor of the private sector. I believe in capitalism. I believe in letting the marketplace win. Yuri Berliner coming out and saying that NPR has been too left and he's watched it happen and he doesn't like it is brave. And good for him for doing it. I think that NPR is not the only person that is guilty of this. I think that you have obvious partisan influences in the media, and I think that there's an opportunity in it to get it better, to balance newsrooms. You shouldn't have, unless they're going to be overtly honest about it, and Fox News is going to say we're a conservative network, and MSNBC is going to say we're a liberal network. If you're not going to come out and say that, then you got to balance the news. You got to balance the perspectives. That has been a big, big push at News Nation from the bosses.
Okay, but you got to answer my actual question, Chris, which is there any good reason for the American taxpayers to fund $500 million for public radio and public TV?
I've told you what the policy argument is. At the end of the day, it's a political question, right? I mean, the argument is that this is done without any kind of deference to a commercial space. That, you know, you're just going to get just the facts, even if it's boring, so people can depend on an outlet not to spin them. I would say you're just better off with the private market and let capitalism control. Let people figure out who's serving them best. I think that the real beef for you is that NPR is lefty. And if NPR was right, I wonder if you'd be bringing it up.
I would. And I'll tell you why, Chris. I've never pulled a government paycheck in my life. I would guess that may be true of you as well.
I don't have any problem with people working for the government. I have no problem with
Well, I do when they work in media. If you're going to tell people, we're going to be a news and information source, but our paychecks are signed at least in part by the United States government. So we're going to have a generally pro-government point of view, which tends to be more the left's point of view, that government is the solution to everything. And the conservatives say that government is a tool. It isn't to be used for everything. And in this case, when the government funds the media, and then amazingly, NPR decides to be very pro-government, very unskeptical of government, and very critical of those who'd like to have a smaller American government, that's generally conservatives and generally not progressives, that you say, well, they're paying the bills. You know, why wouldn't they be pro-government?
To me, is it a necessity? No, it's not a necessity. You know, it is interesting to me how conservatives, you're small government, sure, as long as you're not talking about the corporate welfare laws, as long as you're not talking about the defense industry, you know, which the two biggest spaces of government spending, which conservatives have been in favor of forever, then, yeah, you're for small government, unless you look at the biggest tax cut that we've had that was not revenue neutral in a generation, which was done by Trump. But then, yeah, otherwise,
hold, I love it when people of your, you know, from your side of the aisle, whatever side that is, I know you kind of try and straddle the middle, but when you say that when the government agrees to let people keep more of the money they actually earned, that is government spending.
Which people? Which
citizens?
People,
citizens who work a job like you work, like
which?
I work the. And when you say
which
that's government,
citizens?
Well, no, hold on. All citizens who pull a W-2 paycheck. I imagine that includes you. I know it includes me. I don't know your personal tax situation. But if you pull a W-2 paycheck and the government says, hey, let's let all those people keep more of their paycheck, that is somehow government spending, as though all the money in America belongs to the government except the amount it agrees to give back to the citizens.
That's not the argument. That's not the argument. Obviously, here's what it is. When you say you're giving a middle-class tax cut and you give 80-plus cents out of every dollar of cut to the top and not the middle class, that's not a middle-class tax cut. Don't call it that. Don't deceive people.
But
am I in favor of tax cuts? Of course I am. Who doesn't want to pay less in taxes?
But you're wrong on the numbers, and I'll tell you why. When you give a tax cut...
You don't like them?
No. I can tell you numbers because the biggest proportion...
83 cents of every dollar in Trump's tax cuts went to the top 1%.
Except that's one way of looking. That's one way of looking at it. Let me put it this way. Did the rich in America pay more money or less money after Trump's tax cuts that you say benefited the rich? Did they pay more or less?
They got a tax cut.
No, I'm saying, did they pay more or less? That's a simple question. If you're saying they got the biggest share of the cut.
They got a tax cut, so they paid less in taxes.
Okay, then how do you square that up? The IRS, after all the tax tricks and the shelters and the deductions and everything else, what they actually collect is a good measure of who pays the bill. So before the Trump tax cuts passed by a Congress and then signed by the president, but they give him the credit, I'm happy to see him get the credit for it. Before that, the rich, the top 1%, according to the IRS's own collections, paid 41% of the entire federal tax bill. Today, the latest numbers from the IRS from 2023 say they pay 46%. So they actually saw their share of how much they pay of the entire bill go up by more than 10%. Now, how is it that this only benefited the rich when the rich today, top 1%, are paying more money than they were paying before the Trump tax cuts, if what you say is true?
Well, what I'm saying is absolutely true, because it's not like I did the numbers, right? The numbers were given to us by the same people who did the tax cuts. Well, two things can be true at once, Lars. The rate went down. But economically, there was so much more money made, especially on the corporate side, that they wound up paying more overall, even though the rate was lower, because they made so much more money.
Why did the proportion of the bill paid? It's like going to dinner with 100 people.
Because corporations have been killing it. They have been killing it economically. And the workers have not been killing it the same way. I'm surprised at you, Lars. You know this. It's like what we're seeing with gas prices right now. They didn't make their money during the pandemic. They've been gouging us with prices.
They're not doing it because of the cost of crude oil, because you want to compare the cost of crude oil during Donald Trump and the cost of crude oil during Joe Biden?
Yes or no? America has pumped more oil than it ever has before in history. Yes or no?
And yes. And do you know why?
So that's declaring
war on the
industry?
Chris, you know why? Because when Joe Biden bumped the oil prices from $40 a barrel to $80, if you and I owned an oil well, we'd be pumping like crazy. We'd say it's $80 a barrel. Let's sell it while the price is high.
Market, Lars, you are being deceptive with your audience. Oil and gas prices are a world market.
And did Joe Biden help to bump the cost of oil?
Control.
Did Joe Biden help to bump the cost of oil up by declaring, we won't even need oil in 10 years. I'm going to declare war. I'm not going to lease any more federal ground for drilling. I'm going to put every limit I can on the oil industry. Did he cause a price?
He has not put every limit. Pumping more oil. Now,
this is
new
drilling.
Regulation is better.
New drilling.
But there is more new drilling. Are they drilling in places that Trump wanted to and Biden did not? No, obviously, because Biden is the president. If you don't like that, don't vote for the guy.
Hey, you're listening to the Lars Larson Show, and I always have fun talking to my liberal friend Chris Cuomo, the ultimate naysayer. Now, if you want to hear the entire interview, you can check out the download at LarsLarson.com. You can also find me on Instagram and other social media. Glad to have you with me, and always glad to take your emails. Talk@LarsLarson.com.
Another strong take from President Biden on AI and the weather.
Helping web telescope. My God, what is this?
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's the Radio Northwest Network. On a Monday, I'm going to go to a naysayer here in just a moment. But I got to tell you about this. I've always called them killer whales. And I know the politically correct folk call them orcas. They say that killer whale thing. That's unfair. Well, I'll tell you what, go to my website at LarsLarson.com and check out the video of a killer whale that goes out and just does a number on, guess what, a great white shark. Yeah, a full Jaws-sized shark. And this killer whale just does a number on this shark. If that shark lived through it, I'd be amazed. But we posted the video because I thought it was great. Why don't we drop all the woke orca nonsense and just call them what they are? I don't think it's an insult to say about an animal that it's a killer whale when it can actually do in one of the biggest apex predators literally on the planet. This segment of the show is brought to you by NickShivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately. No showings, no hassles, and you pick the closing date. NickShivers.com for details. And our X poll today, you can find the question at Lars Larson Show. Should America leave abortion decisions to the states? That's Donald Trump's position. Or should we have one nationwide rule that says abortions anytime, anywhere, and for any reason? That would be the Joe Biden position. You can find the question at Lars Larson Show on X. It's brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. We love naysayers on this program, so let me go to Gary. Gary, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What do you and I disagree about today?
Okay, Lars, I know you like to be flattered to have everybody say how much
I don't. I don't care.
So,
no.
Okay.
Well, but I really don't. It's nice if you like the show.
Now you asked me for a,
yes,
I am. For a comment. I'm gonna
what
make
do we
comment.
Disagree about,
Hold
Gary?
On. Listen, do I ask for you? I'm 79 years old. I need some respect from you. So respect your elders. And
you earn respect.
Okay. You have a very misguided
Joe
opinion.
Is old, too, and I don't respect him at all.
Pardon me?
Are Joe Biden is old, too, and I don't respect him at all.
Are you listening to me?
Yes.
Now, I was told not to use any profanity in this broadcast, and you're going to start prompting things that I don't want to say. Now, let me get to the point. You have a misguided impression of unions.
I do.
And
why?
My dad was a union member and a Teamster in 1944. I joined the Teamsters in 1964. I've been in and out. I've had withdrawals, but I never gave up my Teamster membership. Teamsters have a tough way of negotiating with certain people. Ford Motor Company had goons that would break up any union negotiations back in the early days.
Gary, they engage in extortion.
Have you ever had a union? Have you ever been in an elevator? Yes or no question.
Yes.
Have you ever been in an elevator?
I said yes.
Elevator constructor unions has a very extensive training program for anybody that's in that profession. And
so what?
If you want to be in an elevator built by a non-union company, you're in trouble.
That's a false notion, too. Hold on. We're going to engage in a conversation, or we won't do it at all. There are electricians in the Northwest who are part of a union training program. There are also state training. There are also other programs that cost the same amount of money, take the same amount of time, and turn out journeyman electricians, and they make the same amount of money, and they are just as well trained. So the idea that the union member is only the only well trained worker you can find to do anything is hogwash.
No, but they're still highly qualified.
No? Well, then tell me this, Gary, tell me this. What is the meaningful difference between a union-trained journeyman electrician, complicated trade, and a non-union-trained journeyman electrician? If you say there is no difference, can you tell me what the difference is?
Okay, a non-union shop can dictate anything they want to their employees, meaning the way they dress, meaning the way they groom, meaning the way
they union dictates things to employees all the time. Unions will say, you don't have a job today. You know, why not? Well, because we gave it to one of your union brothers. He was higher up the list. Tell me that ain't true.
Well, there's been other issues with unions that I don't really want to get into. I don't want
No, I know you don't want to get into them because they disapprove what you're saying, Gary.
Not necessarily.
Well, tell me this. Tell me this. Does the union tell you, I'm sorry, Gary, you won't be working here today. We've sent you to Seattle or to Tacoma or to some other place. They need help there. And if you want to work, you go there. We've given your job to another member who has seniority over you.
No, never had that happen to me in all my life.
It happens to other union members that I've talked to.
Well, they have a weak union, man.
It's some of the strongest unions around. But Gary, what is it? You started with. I started by asking you what we disagree with. What do you think is my misimpression of unions?
All right, I did have to go to NLRB to file.
I didn't ask you that. I ask you, what is the misimpression you think I have of unions? I've always said, under the Constitution and federal laws, you have a right to join a union. If you want to be in a union, do I think it's foolish? Yes, I do. But tell me what you think. What is my misimpression?
And they're not. They're part of the dues that you pay for somebody who negotiates for you.
No, hold on. Gary, I'll give you a good example. There are 53,000 unionized teachers in the state of Oregon. They collect $53 million in union dues. They spend about $10 million of that on negotiating and grievances and everything else, and they spend the rest on politics. Why is it that 80 to 90% of union dues go to politics that have nothing to do with negotiating?
I have no idea.
I do, because the Democrats love the unions, and they love the money they get from them, and those unions strip that money out of union members' pockets and give it to Democrats who most of those union members don't even like. Thank you, Gary.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show.